All right, let me just make sure that everything is.
Let's just start with one or two minor things first to allow you to sort of. I went through the transcripts and all the material from the last interview.
So did I.
Yeah. And one of the things you mentioned in it was the Fleury correspondence, because you had some early correspondence with Paul Fleury. But you were going to clear it with Emily Fleury.
I've not done a thing, but I've got it still.
I mean, did you send copies to the centre?
I haven't even done that. No, it's. I'm sorry, you know, the editing macromolecules, I'm one of the associate editors, has gotten an ever more demanding chore, at least with respect to my energy and abilities, I guess. I'm hardly lecturing at all. I'm still trying to write papers. I've all of a sudden got a couple of small research ideas now that I have no collaborators. Do all the calculations myself, but... The Fleury project should have been done a couple of years ago, and I just haven't got around to it. It's on schedule for the spring to do that, and so then they'll all turn up. I've got the material.
Yeah,
right. Including the first letter he ever wrote to me in 1942.
But you know you have the Fleury papers here.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think they ought to be sent here as far as... I can easily make copies of anything that I consider.
Sure. But I was thinking in terms of the joint memoir you're writing with, who was it you're writing it with?
Johnson and Talbot, both his colleagues at Stanford.
Right.
And in fact, Talbot has already written something for the American Philosophical
Society.
That's
what I'm thinking of, yeah.
Yeah. And is the thing on?
Yeah.
Well,
you want to?
Yeah.
Okay. Right, well. I think when we stopped the last interview, I think for lack of time, as I recall, we were around 1953. You had, I think, been talking about your collaboration with Marshall Fix. We touched upon the computer.
Somewhere in MIT we stopped, yes, right.
We sort of jiggered backward and forward a bit there. I thought one good point to start this interview would be to talk about your Guggenheim Fellowship to Strasbourg in 1954, which we didn't
discuss. No, that's correct, yes.
And, I mean, how did that come about, and why did you pick Strasbourg in particular?
Well, I picked Strasbourg partly because I had met Henri Benoit, who had had a year with Paul Doty at Harvard.
Okay,
I didn't know Sadon personally, but Paul Doty, who was at Harvard and good friend since his grad school days at Columbia when I was an instructor, said, Sadon is just the kind of fellow you'd enjoy working near, and why don't you go to Strasbourg? It's a good place. So I wrote to Sadon, who said, sure, if you want to come here, we'll have a room for you. In fact, the new building is going to be ready in the fall of 54, so I applied for the Guggenheim and carried out, perhaps some of the work I'd planned to do, as usual. It never turns out the way you think.
That's right. So, I mean, what was your experience like in Strasbourg? I mean, what sort of work did you manage to achieve while you were over there?
Oh, there were a few papers, and what I sort of learned, of course, I learned to know a whole new coterie of people. Travel wasn't all that common then. Some of the big shots had come over reasonably frequently, but I got to know a nice bunch of young Frenchmen and a few Germans on some trips across there. I must say, because of my father's South German origin, I still had cousins and an aged aunt at that time. And my parents, my own father and mother, came over in the fall of 54, his first visit to Stuttgart since 1921. He was bitterly disappointed that the world had not stood still over there. Things were different. But anyhow, so going to Alsace was partly also a cultural idea. I didn't yet want to go to Germany. It was too soon after the war. It was a feeling that I didn't want anything to do with ex-Nazis, and I didn't know how Americans would be received or what kind of relations there would be. In the event, they turned out to be marvelous, but in any case, I was not anxious to stay in Germany.
Right, okay.
And Alsace was reputedly and indeed a mixture of French and German.
Right.
They used to joke that the cooking was French in quality and German in magnitude of the dishes.
Well, presumably you knew German anyway because of your family background.
I knew a great deal of German. I spoke it as a child before English, and I'd done quite a lot of French in school, so I wasn't afraid of doing French. In fact, lectured in French here and there.
Right.
Usually observing a few wry little smiles or remarks when I said something foolish.
Yeah. Did you meet Staudinger when you went over?
Who?
Staudinger, Hermann Staudinger.
Indeed, right. He was in Freiburg, and I called on him. I used to, in fact, because I had my Guggenheim stipend. It came from the U.S. in dollars, and I had a friend who was also a geologist who was working in Strasbourg, Henry Fall, who had a Fulbright and was paid in French francs.
Okay.
So monthly we drove together to Basel. And by exchanging, I did a certain amount of changing dollars for francs directly. I don't know. Anyhow, we both benefited from the deal somehow. I needed French francs and he wanted something else. I really don't remember the details. But anyhow, one way to go from Strasbourg to Basel, not the shortest way, is to pass through Freiburg. So I had written to Professor Staudinger, and he said, come on over. So I did. He had, at that time, the place was still an old, not fully reconstructed, the old chemistry institute. He had just two assistants, people named Kressig and Hahn. And Walter Hahn eventually came to the United States and worked for DuPont in Virginia. I never saw him again, that I recall. Kressig also disappeared somewhere in the German industry. But these two guys and Staudinger.
Okay. Were the only three in the department, effectively? Were they the only three people in the department at last?
As far as I know, there might have been some grad students as well, but I was only introduced to these folks. And Staudinger must have talked to me for about half an hour and handed me some reprints of recent work. He seemed more annoyed that the Americans had not honored the royalties on his patent for a coffee substitute.
Oh, right. He did that work with Reichstein, I think.
I think so, yeah.
And then the First World War. What was your impression of Staudinger, as a person?
Well, I guess grand old man is all I could say. He was very affable, and he was not about to start quarreling all over again with Hermann Mark at the time, although when Staudinger eventually did come to the States, I think it was 1958,
okay,
he did come by MIT and gave a lecture in German, and it was my job to translate every 5 minutes worth from German to English, which I was pleased to do. By this time, he had given up the notion that all polymers were rod-like and had even sort of made up with Hermann Mark.
Right.
Though again, since sometimes the spouses take these things more seriously, are we still, are we taping right now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fine.
Can you stop it?
Yeah.
That recorded either. That's not the kind of history. Well, maybe it is, but
I would like to ask you about the sorting of marks, but coming back. One other question I was going to ask you about your stay in Strasbourg. What was your impression of European polymer chemistry compared with what you'd known in the United States? I mean, did they approach it in a different way, did you think? Was it less sophisticated?
No, I don't think that it was all that different. I mean, one of the people I had, Benoit was a very good statistical mechanicer from natural ability in a right way, and Sandro, although he was now much more of an administrator, was certainly doing top flight work. And over in Germany, Arnold Münster, who eventually left polymers for more formal statistical mechanics, was doing polymer work, and I visited him several times. Turned out he was a musician too, so, you know.
Right.
And I did think that in Germany I found sort of two camps. There were some really industrially oriented people sitting in university slots, and I had, well, not very much in common with them, both in terms of my own background and natural interest. But no, of course, I traveled around, visited the polymer chemists in Paris, Champetier and Maga, and in Belgium, in Liège, there was Victor Dereux, who was one of the early people doing first-rate light scattering.
Right.
And so I thought the caliber was pretty damn good. Moreover, at the opening in September of the... at the opening of Sandro's new building in September of 1954, he had a really starry crew assembled to give lectures. There was a small volume published on that. Harry Melville was there from England, so was Butler, who was working on DNA at the time, which Sadro got interested in. Herman Mark, G.V. Schultz, Kuhn, you know, it was big. And Aaron Kachalski. And there's a funny sideline. Kachalski is the only one who didn't turn in a manuscript, but they had taped his lecture, just as you're taping this. Unfortunately, although Kachalski spoke tolerable English, he did so with a strong Polish plus Israel accent, and none of the French people could figure out what the hell he was saying, and they asked me, as somebody whose native language was English, essentially, could I sit and commit to paper the Kachalski lecture. Well, I did, but I had to play the thing about 25 times before I could figure out some of the things he was saying. But of course, the science was understood. He was talking about polyelectrolytes, which were very new then and exciting. Great man, very interesting.
Yeah, of course. Let's talk a little bit now about your final years in MIT,
mm-hmm.
because you came back in 55 and you have roughly five more years at MIT.
Yes, right.
We talked in the last transcript about the people you knew at MIT, Arthur Koch, for example.
Sure.
Is there anything about those final 5 years that you feel might be worth mentioning? For example, in the last transcript, you did say that you thought that Koch's influence was waning in that period.
Well, my own feeling was that his center of interest had shifted from the banks of the Charles River to Washington, D.C. He was heavily involved in ACS affairs.
Right.
He had been president. He was about to become chairman of the board. And the department, he'd done a major job of building it up into a good one from what hadn't been that.
Right.
And I think perhaps he felt everything was going all right. But in any case, he didn't seem to hear what I was trying to say. We were a group of 11 faculty members in physical chemistry, and we had a couple of very bright young people. The super bright one was John Waugh,
okay.
later a Wolf Prize winner, as you may know, one of the really expert NMR people of the world, the guy who essentially invented the pulse sequence NMR that made solid-state NMR possible. He didn't get the Nobel Prize. The guy from Zurich did, who developed it much further, but John was really in the running, I should have thought.
Right.
Now, John Waugh had a nasty little laboratory in the basement, and he was getting the best students, and it was crowded to beat hell, and he needed more space. And I was then on my 3-year term as a rotating chairman of the physical chemistry subgroup in the department. To cope, Art, John Waugh is an absolutely first-rate guy. He needs more space, and I know just the lab, just the place you could give him. Here's this thing that used to be for qualitative analysis. It's nothing but a repository of samples now. For God's sake, give it to him for a laboratory. Cope said, well, I'll think about it. Nothing happened. The next thing I knew, that very room had been converted to an editorial office for Fred Green in the Journal of Organic Chemistry.
Okay.
John Waugh was still in the basement.
Okay.
So that got me a little bit disappointed, let me say. The other reason that I can discern for moving off was that I really felt I was going stale in research. I had some very, very good students, never again another Fixman, but some very competent people, but I was disappointed that I wasn't giving any problems that seemed really exciting either to them or me anymore. I don't want to mention more names, it's irrelevant. And I thought, well, maybe I've done all I've got a chance of doing, but I know I'm a good teacher, at least I can go to a place where, and I knew Dartmouth through John Wolfenden, an English-born physical chemist at Dartmouth who had, well, I'd go into his lectures in Oxford and got to know him then since. So when the sort of quite accidental chance came to go up there, I went and had a look and I said, well, maybe this is really what I ought to do because I know I can teach these undergraduates. They're bright, but they're not all science directed. It's a different place. It's a new atmosphere. I like mountains and it's closer. And that coupled with the fact that I really felt that the things in the department I couldn't, at MIT, I couldn't seem to be make happen, I decided to go.
Okay.
But I didn't play around with it. I didn't say, well, I'll stay if, or anything like that. I made up my mind and then told them I was going, and I didn't change it. I don't like this business of bargaining. Although there are times, I suppose, when it does make sense.
Right.
But the situations were so different here. It wasn't a sideways move. It was something different. I can mention that in 1959, I did go out to La Jolla at the invitation of Harold Urey, who had gone there, and Jim Arnold was there. The campus that became UC San Diego was essentially non-existent. There were very few people there. And they asked me if I'd like to go out there and join the department.
Wow.
And it was tempting in a way. I always admired Urey greatly, and I liked Arnold, and you know, the idea that Roger Revell was then the local chancellor, I guess you could say, and he painted a picture that, well, it was destined to remain only a vision. It was going to be a campus limited to only 6,000 students, almost all of whom would have science or engineering as their interest. In other words, another Western Institute of Technology to rival Caltech or something like that. Eh bien, that didn't happen, of course. It's a $25,000 branch of the university. No, but what Urey said was, if he had known me, he would never have said it. He said, we want you to come out here and you'll be the next chairman for a while and you'll be able to design the building, the new building.
No.
I hate designing buildings. I couldn't imagine doing it.
No.
So I just...
It's not why you turned it down.
Essentially, the main reason. Plus, I thought, well, not so bad at MIT, but within a couple of years, I had really convinced myself that I wasn't doing good research just then, and maybe I should.
Yeah. What about, who made you the offer to go to Dartmouth? I mean, did they sort of make an attempt to get you?
They did, in a way. I don't know how interesting this is. I had a friend named Manuel Morales. He's a biochemist. He was at the Dartmouth Med School then as chairman of biochemistry. He moved to NIH not so many years after that.
Yeah.
He had done some light scattering theory, so we'd had some correspondence. We were both at the summer study in Boulder, Colorado in the summer of 1958. On biophysical science that Francis O. Schmidt at MIT had organized. There's a big volume of collections of lectures about that. Schmidt's idea was that he could get people in various branches of biology and biophysics to talk to each other and to physical scientists who had perhaps an interest in learning more about what they could do in the biological area. So Doty was there, Zim was there, Stuart Rice, John Ferry, amongst people I already knew, but a hell of a lot of biologists and some real physicists. Charlie Townes was there, essentially inventor of the maser, you know, and laser. Morales was there, when I first saw him, I said, well, how are things going at NIH? And he said, oh, I'm not there. I'm up at Dartmouth. And I said, are you? You're a lucky guy, because I thought of mountains, you know. I have love with the White Mountains. So. And apparently he went home having remembered that remark. And Dartmouth had got a slug of money from the Rockefeller Foundation to increase the pure science component in the medical school, but they had a promise from the president, John Dickey, to do a little more with appointments in the physical science departments of Dartmouth College. So he went and talked to Wolfenden, and Wolfenden, I think, was the person who got in touch with me. And they asked me up. And there was another connection. In the physics department, there was one of the most successful physics textbook writers of the century, Francis W. Sears. Sears had taught me physics as an undergraduate at MIT. One term. He'd gone up to Dartmouth on a sabbatical year, liked it very well, they liked him, and he stayed on. So I went to see him and asked, Francis, how do you like it up here? I mean, is it good Sunday? Oh, it's marvelous. You know, I mean, he really sold me on it. So then I went home with the notion that this was something worth considering. No problem.
Okay.
It's rather hard. I do recall sitting down with my wife and trying, perhaps foolishly, to quantify all this. Let's consider all the factors that would go into such a decision, and let's give them each a weight of so many points, and then adding up to 100, and award the points to the institution or the location that would come out ahead. Everything from professional, colleagues, friends, living conditions, you name it. Financial, no consideration. And they made an offer. It was a $500 raise, so that not much. Well, it came out 55 for going and 45 for staying. It was that close. But I tried to redo the calculation no matter how. It roughly came out 60 to 40, 55. So we went.
You thought it dirt.
And one postdoc came with me. He was a Japanese named Kuraha. Came a figure in Japanese polymer science. Michio Kuraha had come to MIT on a two-year fellowship. I wish the hell I could even remember now which auspices were involved. A large program of two-year foreign fellowships for people in all the disciplines, not just chemistry. But Michio had, from March until August, still left, and I moved up in March of 1961. And I said, you can certainly stay at MIT and I'll be in touch with you. You've got your place here and you're amongst friends. What would you rather do? I would like to come with you. So he did, and while he was there, we finished a monster review article for one of the first volumes of Fortschritte der Hochpolymer Chemie. And it was in there that the error occurred, which I have to talk about sometime. This was an enormous collection of data on the conformations and solution viscosities of polymers of all kinds in solution. And since it was an enormous job, he did 90% of the work, I should think, probably, of putting all this together. We discussed the theory of light scattering and of the conformation, the excluded volume effect, the whole bit, and then data on all sorts of polymers. Amongst them was one particular one, and that was polyoxymethylene. Later, Delrin wasn't on the market yet, but they were working on it. There wasn't much data on conformations because
they hadn't found solvents for the big polymer, and Staudinger had some very, very old data in his book, but not much. And some Japanese had measured some dipole moments, and we calculated on those, and we forgot that in this case, where the gauche conformation is favored so that the thing likes to make helices, that the so-called pentane effect, a gauche plus gauche minus interference, which is a relatively minor thing for a great many of the vinyl polymers, is just an enormous thing here. And we left it out. As a result, we got a numerical answer for this polymer was just ridiculous. Wow. Said it would essentially roll up into a ball. Well, wow. When I realized that, and is the other thing had just been published, but people hadn't called me on it yet, I decided I would publish a correction. And I don't know what where the whimsy came from. Anyhow, I used a pseudonym, which is slightly indecent. There was a good physicist named Rudolf Eisenschitz. He was a collaborator of London and Germany, and then he got a professorship at University College London. And I had fun with the idea of using another element in the periodic table and coined the name Waldemar Zilberschitz, which is WS, my initials, has this, high school level joke with the indecent word. I spelled it in a slightly Polish way, the S-Z-Y-C instead of S-C-H-I-T-Z. I wrote a letter to the editor of Polymer Letters, Charlie Overberger, pointing out the error in this review article and citing some of the old Staudinger data, along with a back of the envelope first approximation putting in the pentane effect, and got a more reasonable answer, and sent it in. At the end of the article, I said, "The writer thanks W.H. Stockmeyer for a useful soliloquy." And it was accepted and published.
Wow, amazing.
And the address was my P.O. box in Norwich, Vermont, which some people think is a college town. There is a Norwich University, a military college in the center of Vermont. It started in Norwich, but when the buildings burned down back in the 19th century, they moved over to another town far away, north of. But a lot of people still think, "Oh, Norwich. Oh, that's sure. That's a college." So it was
correspondent on that paper.
I got a request for a reprint from none other than Anton Peterlin. So I sent Peterlin a copy with a forward message subscribed to by the author. I never heard any more about that. No. No, I heard at least one person quote it in a lecture, perfectly seriously.
How well known was the fact that it was you?
Oh, I guess only amongst my pals for a long time. I don't think I did anything special about advertising it. Stretch Winslow and I had fun with the name later, because when I had for a while to, I had to leave the associate editorship for a while when I had to be department chairman again. Bob Cleland sat in for me. Then when I came back to being an editor, there was part of a year where there would be a blank on the masthead under the editorial advisory board members.
What journal was that?
My name had been there, but now I resumed being an associate editor. Okay. So now that left a blank on the advisory board. So we put Waldemar Zilberschitz up there for a few months. Charlie Birch knew about it, I guess. I'm not sure he liked it, but it's kind of silly.
That, just before we move
pure
on.
Puerile, we'd say, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Sorry?
I said it's a puerile episode.
Just before we move on, I want to discuss a couple of your papers and their papers. But just before we do, one person that struck me that you never mentioned in the transcript was A.B. Morton, despite the fact he was at MIT. In fact, I noticed in your bibliography that you did do one paper on orphan polymers.
Okay.
He died, unfortunately, just since we last spoke. But yes. I mean, perhaps, did you know A.B. at all?
Oh, sure. In fact, we remain friendly, which you can't say of too many of Avery's colleagues. But I thought his, you know, his chemistry was brilliantly empirical. I mean, making the polymer this way, his ideas about how it worked were pretty nonsensical, I think. And the reason he quarreled with Roberts was partly over that, but many other things.
The reason I was a co-author. I said, well, Avery, at least, you know, we should be able to do a little bit. We should be able to do some polymerization kinetics in the case of the isoprene polymer, which doesn't go too fast and it's reasonably soluble. So we'll get some reaction rates. And two of the people who worked on his projects did some of the work on that. Another was Bob Cleland, who was then doing a master's thesis